When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
Count one, unintentional second-degree murder, guilty. Count two, third-degree murder, guilty. Count three, second-degree manslaughter, guilty. Bail is revoked, bond is discharged, and the defendant is remanded to the custody of the Hennepin County Sheriff.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
Oh, yeah.
I'm gonna miss him. But now I know he's in history.
Yay.
What a day to be a Floyd.
This is a victory for all of us.
Yeah.
There's no color boundary on this. This is everyone who's been held down, pinned down.
Yeah.
And you know what, people? And we standing together in unity.
The brothers of George Floyd reacting after a jury finds Derek Chauvin guilty of murder. The first such conviction of a white police officer against a black civilian in the state of Minnesota. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Wednesday, April 21st. Guilty on all charges was the verdict rendered after 10 hours of deliberations for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed a black man named George Floyd on May 25th of last year by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Chauvin's bond was revoked, and he was immediately remanded to custody at the Oak Park Heights Correctional Facility, where he will spend the next 8 weeks awaiting sentencing. He faces up to 40 years in prison. Minneapolis residents who gathered outside the courthouse celebrated the verdict with tears and relief, and crowds at the scene of Floyd's death erupted into cheers for a guilty on all counts verdict that many were unsure they would get. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison spoke at a news conference with the prosecutors who tried the case.
I would not call today's verdict justice, however, because justice implies true restoration. But it is accountability, which is the first step towards justice. We need true justice. That's not one case. That is a social transformation that says that nobody's beneath the law and no one is above it.
Now, no verdict can bring George Perry Floyd back to us. But this verdict does give a message to his family that he was somebody, that his life mattered, that all of our lives matter.
Let's bring in the host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton, and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham. Good to have you both to start off this morning.
Reverend Al, you were there. You have been with the family from the start. Tell us how they were doing, how they reacted to the verdict yesterday.
Well, the court had COVID restrictions, so only one member of the family could be in the courtroom. So the rest of the brothers and cousins and his daughter, we were all at a nearby hotel, and we didn't know what to expect. It was a lot of anxiety and a lot of hope. And I must say, out of the years I've been involved in this and have stood with families, marched with them, rallied with them through National Action Network, this family was stronger and more hopeful than most that I've dealt with. But even then, you don't know. And when the it came across the screen, the judge reading the verdict, I looked over at the brothers and all of us just simultaneously bust out in tears. It was just to see grown men cry and then women start weeping. And it was the most emotional reaction I've seen in the decades I've been involved. And he said, guilty the second time and guilty the third time. And all of us just started embracing each other, because I think deep down inside, We believed it, but we just wasn't sure. We've seen tapes before. We've seen videos before. Eric Garner was a video. They never even were charged in that case. We saw the video 30 years ago with Rodney King. Those policemen were acquitted. So somewhere deep in, you just always wanted to reserve the right to say, well, I didn't go for it all the way. And then the walls burst, and you got at least this guilty this time. And you could say, maybe we can make a difference. And this family just sobbed and wept and was hugging each other and waiting on Philonis to come. President Biden called and talked to Vice President Harris. But I think that the main thing that they really felt for was that they lost their brother, and now he meant something bigger than them, and that all these months that they joined all of us was not in vain.
You know, Reverend, for some reason, yesterday after that verdict, in many ways a historic verdict, it was in vogue to say that justice was not done. Hmm. Somehow this was not enough. Justice was not done. That just ignores history. From Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin to Eric Garner to so many different cases to George Floyd, those were cases where justice was not done. In this one case, and the law requires us to take it one case at a time, justice was done. And it was done after one of the largest social movements ever. And let me say again, for people that want to denigrate what happened yesterday, minimize what happened yesterday, Rev, you've seen it. We've talked about it. This is the first case where one police officer after another police officer after another police officer testified against the action of one of their own. This was different. This did make a difference. Don't you think people should stop for a second and say, hey, wait a second. Wait a second. Maybe all the work that we did over the past year in the streets in Washington, maybe it made a difference. Maybe this is something we can build on.
I think that if we do not look at the fact that, yes, the marches and the rallies all over the world, intergenerational, interracial, was impactful. The big over 200,000 people in the pandemic that marched with us when Nash Action Network and Martin the Third called for that, all of that was great. But when we saw policemen, even the chief of police of Minneapolis, get on the stand and testify against a policeman, the reason that was significant, I think it was not only critical to the trial and the jury, it was critical to the movement to say that finally the world gets it. This is not anti-police. This is about police accountability, to where even now policemen could say, wait a minute, we will break this blue wall of silence. And that's where I think we can now lead to law and legislative change, because this will not matter in history if we do not make permanent legal change, legislative change. We must now transition from an episodic movement to a historic movement, and that requires new laws. And I think those policemen breaking the blue wall of silence will help us get there.
Rev, you and I sat next to each other on this set last week and talked about the evidence that was in front of us, all the testimony we heard, and you said the prosecution made a great case, but I've seen this before. We all hold our breath to wait because it is so hard to win convictions against police officers. So when we got the announcement of the three verdicts, guilty, guilty, guilty yesterday, and then that image, Rev, of former Officer Chauvin being placed into handcuffs and led out of the room, that is the moment I heard from so many people yesterday was the one that got them, because there was so much history, there was so much frustration, there were so many years bound up in that moment where the police officer was not held accountable. What did that moment mean to you, and what do you think it means more broadly?
I think that when I saw this policeman handcuffed, what it meant to me is it sent a signal to police all over this country that this is what I could face if I take the law for granted, that I can do whatever I want to do and I will not be held accountable. I would have hoped that we could have restored George's life. But since that was not the case, that photo is in the mind of every police officer this morning that I will be held accountable. They will remember seeing him handcuffed and brought to prison, a policeman, just like we do any others that break the law. And we must remember, it's not over. I think that the historian Meacham can tell us, I call him Deacon Meacham. He can tell us behind every big breakthrough in a movement, you still have to do the follow-up. Where's the legislation going? Tomorrow, right. Dante Wright, a 20-year-old killed by a 26-year veteran who said she thought her gun was a taser, killed him. I'm doing a eulogy at his funeral here in Minneapolis in the same county tomorrow morning. So this is not over. We've got to fight for legislative change. The fact we have the White House supporting, the fact we have some in Congress supporting, all of that is well and good, but Lyndon Johnson supported it, but they had to pass that voting rights bill and civil rights bill. We need legislative change, and we need policemen to sit in front of that Congress, just like they got on that stand, and say, yes, there must be accountability built into the laws of this country.
Accountability, maybe this is precedent and certainly a turning point. 2020 will be remembered for the pandemic, but also for the movement of racial justice. The death of George Floyd sparked a once-in-a-generation shift not seen since the civil rights movement, a shift in policing, a shift in the minds of many white Americans, and a shift in the minds of Black Americans that change is possible. His death turned the Black Lives Matter hashtag after the death of Trayvon Martin into a movement that's reached all 50 states and beyond. There was resistance, the most memorable in our own nation's capital, when the government that fought so hard for justice and freedom abroad used force to clear peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square near the White House. But the fight did not stop there. Those fighting for justice persisted, and a new generation was born, a generation of young people standing on the shoulders of those who came before them. John Meacham, you're the author of the biography of John Lewis, entitled His Truth is Marching On. What would he think of the change that we've seen over the last year? I think of that almost iconic picture of him standing, I think with his arms crossed on the Black Lives Matter painted in Washington, D.C. on the street. We'll show it in a moment. I wonder what he would be thinking today.
He would be thinking that we are a step closer to what he and Dr. King and James Lawson and others thought of as the beloved community, which is basically the kingdom of heaven coming to fruition and reality on earth, a place where we actually love our neighbors as ourselves, where, as hard as it is, we love our enemies. As the prophet Amos says, justice comes down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. John Lewis believed that if enough of us had the correct and loving dispositions of heart and mind, that we could bring about that ideal in the temporal world. And that's the single most difficult thing for people who are theologically or historically minded to contemplate, because it is about human perfection when human beings define imperfection, you know, with our whole being. The Constitution of the United States, for all of its failings, was a Calvinist document, essentially, that assumed that we would do the wrong thing most of the time. It's a Calvinistically informed document that because if we had total power, if any element of the Republic had total power, we were most likely to abuse it. And as Winston Churchill has said, you know, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after we've exhausted every other possibility. And so we've always proven, I think, that insight right. What John Lewis and Reverend Sharpton knows this better than I do, what he believed was that patient, brave, nonviolent witness was the best means to redemption. That if he and his colleagues, Ella Baker and Amelia Boykin and Rosa Parks and Hosea Williams and an innumerable host of others whose names we don't know, but who made the best of America possible, if they would stand nonviolently, peacefully, as sentinels and lanterns for the country, for other people, to actually do what we said we wanted to do and be what we say we want to be. And that's closing the gap between a profession in the principles of the Declaration of Independence, that we're all created equal, and the practice of American life for 400 years, which has been to not necessarily to close that gap, but to widen it at times. And the remarkable thing, I think, about this moment, which is simply a, not simply, but it is a step. As Reverend says, we won't know fully what this moment means until we know what comes out of it, both in the hearts and minds of the country and in the legislative reaction. As Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything, and public sentiment has shifted, but has it shifted enough? And so what Congressman Lewis would be doing is he would be saying, close the gap between profession and practice. And so I think that maybe yesterday is Selma, and it's on its way to a Voting Rights Act. But maybe it's the Niagara movement, which was in the 60 years before that, where W.E.B. Du Bois and others went and made a statement of principles that became part of the Black Freedom Movement. Maybe we're a couple of months away from genuine legislative reform, but maybe we're years away. And that's the test ahead of us.
That is the test ahead of us. Whatever this past year was, historians like you will be grappling with it for some time. But it was a single protester who came together with millions of other protesters that marched in the streets, that marched in the streets, not just in America, but across the world. And from, as Bobby Kennedy would say, those ripples on a lake from a million different points created an energy that came together and really did create a change, bent history, Willie. And John Lewis would recognize that history that was made. I knew John pretty well, serving with him and traveling with him a lot. He would be very positive about what happened. He would demand that protests moved forward and that they be peaceful protests. And at the same time, as he had said before, and as he said always, this is not the fight of a day. Mm-hmm. This is not the fight of a month or a year. This is a fight that must continue throughout our lifetimes, peacefully, but in an unrelenting, loving way.
Absolutely. And what an opportunity to show young people in this country, as John Lewis did for so many years and did himself. He was a very young man, as John knows, at Selma. What an opportunity to show that if you see injustice in the world, you can change it. You can push, and you can push peacefully, and you can change it. That was an opportunity to say that to my own kids as we watched this last night. This was a moment for justice and hopefully the beginning of something and not the end of something. We also shouldn't let this moment pass without recognizing Darnella Frazier. She was the 17-year-old high school student who was out with her young cousin getting a snack and saw something that she said in testimony on the stand that just wasn't right. She saw a police officer's knee on a man's neck. It looked like the man was dying. Darnella pulled out her phone.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
And recorded those 10 minutes that the world saw. She posted it to Facebook. Darnella Frazier, 17 years old, now 18 years old, is the reason we witnessed this and is the reason most likely that there was a conviction yesterday. Let's bring into the conversation civil rights attorney and former Brooklyn, New York prosecutor Charles Coleman and former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama and MSNBC legal analyst Joyce Vance. Good morning to you both. Charles, let me begin with you. 24 hours ago, we sat here together and you said, look, it just takes one juror. Just takes one juror to hang this jury. What happened yesterday? Were you surprised that all three came back as convictions?
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Once I saw how quickly they had a verdict, I knew that that was a good sign. At the end of the day, there are only three options that we were looking at. Either we were looking at an unanimous acquittal, a unanimous conviction, or a hung jury. And the reality is, I was very much so convinced that there was no way that there were going to be 12 people that in that amount of time came to the conclusion that absolutely nothing that Derek Chauvin had done had left him criminally liable. So I was able to immediately eliminate the possibility of an acquittal once I realized how quickly the jury came back. After that, all we're left with is the possibility of a hung jury. We had not heard anything about a mistrial or a conviction. And I knew that the judge was not going to allow a hung jury at that point, quite frankly, because there just hadn't been enough time. So I knew that there was going to be a conviction on something. And then at that point, it was just a question of what charge or charges were they going to convict Derek Chauvin of? And when we got back into the courtroom, we saw that it was all three. And so the amount of time that the jury deliberated and came to a verdict was an immediate indicator for me and for a number of different trial attorneys who have experienced that this was going to be a good sign for prosecutors after having laid out a brilliant and very methodical, intentional case.
You know, Charles, we had talked yesterday about the jury instructions, how even the jury instructions, you looked at them and thought it might take the jurors, once they got back there, once they got settled, once they figured out who the jury four person was going to be, that it might take them half a day to just sort through the jury instructions, figure out what they mean, ask questions. I think it's pretty stunning that this jury went back there. They didn't even ask any questions of clarification by the judge on any instructions. On any documents, on any information, and moved back there and really did for not just the sort of charges that they were weighing, but also the fact that it was a police officer. It seems they moved with, I don't know if it's historic speed, but it remarkable speed. This was beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt for these jurors. They hardly had time to sit down, go through the jury instructions before returning a verdict. Are you surprised by just how quickly they moved?
Quite frankly, I am. The term all deliberate speed comes to mind when I think about how quickly the jurors were able to go through the charges, look at whatever evidence they needed to look at, if any at all, and make the decision that they did. However, one of the things that I had been saying consistently leading up to yesterday and Monday and their closing arguments was that I expected the prosecution to try to make this as simple and straightforward as possible. I expected the prosecution to talk a bit about the need to use your common sense. to trust your eyes. And that's exactly what they did during their summation. So what they did after having been extremely methodical in laying out their case and very, very brilliant in that regard is that they ended with that theme of, listen, you can trust your eyes, use your common sense, because it's only natural that what we have seen on that video gives us an inclination of guilt from the outset. And everything that we heard and saw from the prosecution and the evidence that they set forward confirmed that. So in a way, we shouldn't be entirely surprised that they were able to quickly make a decision. But no, absolutely, Joe, I did not expect or anticipate that it would be this quick.
Yeah, and Joyce Vance, there were some pundits yesterday after the verdict that were saying, nothing to see here, move along, no big deal, no justice done. Those were people that weren't believing their eyes, that weren't believing their ears, because maybe you've seen a police officer be tried and to be convicted basically by the words of his fellow police officers, and then see a jury go in and so quickly move against a police officer instead of doing what they've done in the past throughout the history of this country, and that is giving the benefit of the doubt to a police officer every time. That did not happen yesterday. And Joyce, if this happens regularly, if you've seen this happen many times in Alabama, in Minnesota, please let me know, because I haven't seen it. Yesterday, I was stunned by how quickly the jury came back in.
It's hard to have actually a national profile of what these prosecutions look like because police aren't required to report numbers, Joe, which makes it tough to study. But there's one lone professor at Bowling Green University who collects data on excessive force prosecutions, and he estimates that there have been about 73 convictions over the course of 16 years. So when you think about it, that's not just for homicides, that's for all sorts of excessive force cases. That means very few police officers are being brought to accountability. In my mind, that's what yesterday does. That vision of a police officer being led from a courtroom in handcuffs sends a strong deterrence message. And so yesterday, the verdict was significant on many levels. Verdicts of guilt are always significant for families and victims because they represent, if not full justice, then at least accountability. But here we also see this beginning of deterrence that can impact the conduct of future police officers. And what we've seen just in the last week indicates that that's sorely needed. The last thing that I'll say is this. I heard people suggesting last night, some of, as you say, the pundits, suggesting that this jury was influenced by the fear that the country would break out in riots if they didn't return a verdict of guilt. And I reject that notion. This jury took an oath, told the judge that they could follow it repeatedly, and they were sequestered during their deliberations. And what I'm forced to think about is all of the juries in police cases who I spoke with after they hung or after they rendered acquittals, where jurors, as you said, gave police the benefit of the doubt. They said, we didn't want to ruin the life of a police officer. I think what the Black Lives Matter protests last summer did, I think what the influx of information into the national conscience about the widespread police misconduct that we see did, was it let this jury decide this case based solely on the evidence and the law without some sort of a bias that said that police were above the law. Now yeah. We live in a community where we can possibly have justice for everyone going forward if future juries will act this way as well.
There's hope now. Joyce, can you explain process in terms of Derek Chauvin? He was remanded into custody immediately. What are the next steps? Potential for appeal as well?
The next thing that happens is that Derek Chauvin will be sentenced by the judge. That will take a period of about 8 weeks because the judge will consider the prosecution's request that the sentence be enhanced, that it be increased above the 150 months or 12 and a half years that Minnesota guidelines call for. And then once that sentence has been put in place, Chauvin will very likely remain in custody, but he will have the opportunity to appeal. this has got to be a case that the prosecution feels pretty good about on appeal. Evidence is clearly sufficient to support this verdict, which is always a big issue on appeal. There will, I suspect, be a lot of points of error alleged by the defense, saying that the prosecution put in too many police officers or made comments in closing argument that they shouldn't have. And of course, that will wend its way through the Minnesota appellate courts. But the prosecution tried a clean case here. They were very careful about not injecting any error into the proceedings.
Charles Cumman and Joyce Vance, we really thank you so much this morning. Appreciate you being on. Reverend Al, I'm curious. You and I have talked about so many cases over the past several years where, you know, I've seen you go down and talk to the family of Trayvon Martin, be with other families as well. When we saw what happened to Eric Gardner, Walter Scott, I'm curious, what will you be saying to Trayvon's family and all the other families who you've been with and you've sat with and you've prayed with?
Well, what I've been saying, and I talked to some of them last night, is that the loss of their loved one, sometimes are the steps that we have to walk on to ultimately get to where we have to go. And the fact that you did not get justice, but stayed in a justice movement, made this some way a victory for you. And it gives you the satisfaction to know you didn't fight in vain. Yes, it is a pain that will never go away. But the pain, even in the Floyd family that won a case, won't go away. And many of them said, Reverend, we're going to meet you at Dante's funeral on Thursday. Tomorrow we have another funeral. This won't stop. And just like I was raised by the generation ahead of me, John Lewis and Jesse Jackson and others mentioned Martin Luther King III and Marc Morrell and I, and we seeing younger people coming behind us. Movements are about continuity, which is why you have to be sure about the goal. And we have not done what those ahead of us did. We've not made new law. And we need these families to help us stand up and make new law. So those that died that were wrongly dealt with, well, at least history will have to give them the verdict that the courts didn't.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
President Biden called yesterday's verdict a giant step forward as he and Vice President Harris addressed the nation after Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all counts.
The guilty verdict does not bring back George. But through the family's pain, they're finding purpose. So George's legacy will not be just about his death, but about what we must do in his memory.
Today, we feel a sigh of relief. Still, it cannot take away the pain. A measure of justice isn't the same as equal justice. This verdict brings us a step closer, and the fact is, we still have work to do. We still must reform the system.
The president and vice president also spoke with the Floyd family after the announcement of the verdict.
Nothing is going to make it all better, but at least, God, now there's some justice.
Right.
And, you know, I think
I think a John is coming. My dad is going to change the world. He's going to start to change it now.
That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Amen. Start to change it now.
Your family and history is going to show real leaders at this moment where we needed you. And in George's name and memory, we are going to make sure his legacy is intact and that history will look back at this moment and know that it's an inflection moment.
Vice President Harris speaking there at the end. Let's bring in White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire. Jonathan, good morning. So President Biden said yesterday, quote, we can't stop here. What does that mean as a practical question? How big a priority is police reform for him?
Well, first of all, Willie, there's an extraordinary sigh of relief from the White House yesterday, and they do believe this is an important moment. I was in the White House yesterday, as we heard from the president twice, about the George Floyd case. Once during the afternoon, after the jury was sequestered, but before we had a verdict, in which he said that he had spoken to the family. He suggested the case was, quote, overwhelming, and he was hoping for the right verdict. And there was some back and forth as to whether he should have weighed in at that moment while the trial was still ongoing. But aides said it was because he had just spoken to the Floyd family earlier in the day as well, and really moved by their plight. And we know, of course, he denounced all along what had happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis. And now we heard from him last night say, indeed, this is an important moment, but has to be just a step. So this is a White House now that wants to lean in more into police reform, but it's going to be an uphill climb. Then they've made some moves on executive orders, but now the ball is really in Congress's court. And we know there's a Congress that's already really busy with a lot of the Biden agenda, in particular this infrastructure and jobs program, of which we're going to hear the second part next week as part of the president's 100 days address to Congress. So this is what they want to do, but it's going to require a lot of juggling. But they hope, they feel, they believe that this verdict yesterday will give them some momentum. And certainly their allies, Democratic allies on the Hill, want to do a full court press. And we should expect, aides say, the president's to take this up in a bigger cause, including with a significant speech on policing in the weeks ahead.
Jonathan, the president had, for the most part, declined to weigh in on this trial until yesterday, as the jury was gathering and deliberating and considering the verdict. He did weigh in, saying he was praying for the right verdict. He said he thought the evidence was overwhelming. Press Secretary Jen Psaki kind of fumbled around with that question when asked about it in the briefing room and said he was not weighing in on the case. Why is it that he waited until that moment and spoke about the case and gave his opinion on the case right before the verdict was given?
Well, Willie, this is one he had been following very closely. Senior aides had said that far more than he had let on, he had been watching the developments of the trial, and indeed really felt for the Floyd family. We may recall that last year during the campaign. In fact, after the pandemic hit, I believe it was his first trip from Delaware was to go to the Floyd funeral in Houston. And he met with the family and has stayed in regular touch with them. He did believe, he and his administration, and let's not overlook the vice president here, of course, the first black woman to serve in that office, believe this would be a real victory in some ways for the movement if there was a conviction, because they are so rare of white police officers. And they were, yes, indeed, that there were behind the scenes preparations for what would happen if the other verdict came down. Coordinating with governors and mayors, National Guard responses. Thankfully, none of that was needed last night after the verdict, the White House believes. But the president felt like he couldn't wait any longer, that the jury was sequestered, that he felt it was a moment where he could weigh in. He had just spoken to the family and felt that it was a moment where he could offer his support and prayers. And the Floyd family suggested they were glad for it because they know that Joe Biden is someone who has suffered immense personal loss in his own life, that they felt a real connection with him. He knows what it's like to lose a child. And he knows what it's like to feel such pain. So he took that moment after the jury was sequestered to weigh in. Certainly the White House really relieved last night. The verdict came in. It came in so quickly, and they do want to try to build off of this going forward.
Let's bring in NBC News correspondent Shaquille Brewster in Oak Park Heights, Minnesota, outside the prison where Derek Chauvin is being held. Describe the scene yesterday when the verdict came down.
Well, I was inside that park right outside of the courthouse as that verdict was being read. And it was people gathered very quickly after we got word of the verdict. It was about an hour, hour and a half that we got when that there was a verdict and before it was announced in the courtroom. And you saw this crowd start to form very quickly. And when the court resumed, people looked down at their phones. They were watching. They were listening, putting it up to their ear. And there was a hush that came over the crowd. And then you heard someone on a bullhorn say guilty. And that's when people just went into exuberance. I think we're playing some of that moment right now. You see the hugs that were there. You see some tears in people's eyes. Then they hushed again, and you heard it again, guilty. And that played out three different times. And, you know, one thing that you really got a sense of from the people there is that there was a genuine relief. There was a lot of skepticism, and this is what people told me really since George Floyd died almost a year ago, that they didn't think this day would come. They saw the trial. They watched the video over and over. They heard from the bystanders. They heard from the officers one after another coming up and saying that this was excessive force that was being used, but they wouldn't let themselves believe that Derek Chauvin would be convicted with the jury of his peers. And that's what these protesters got, and that's what these demonstrators got yesterday. We saw protests and peaceful demonstrations throughout the city of Minneapolis. There was a march from the courthouse around the downtown area. There were hundreds of people that gathered at George Floyd Square, the intersection that is still closed off to this day, that exact spot where George Floyd was killed, again, about a year ago at this point. You hear that word over and over again. It's relief that people say that they feel this is the justice that many of them have been calling for now that Derek Chauvin has been declared a murderer and is now at this federal prison behind me, or excuse me, at the state prison behind me.
All right, NBC's Shaquille Brewster, thank you very much.
So, John Meacham, Reverend Sharpton has talked about legislation that needs to be passed. We've seen Joe Biden moving through, almost 100 days. He's coming up to that 100-day point, and it's been a surprising, progressive 100 days. It's been far more substantive than many people expected. How does the passing of legislation that answers many of the questions that were asked over this past year, how important is that for him, just as Truman desegregating the armed forces in 47, 48, and LBJ in 64 and 65? Passing landmark civil rights and voting rights legislation. How important is it for Joe Biden's legacy to get this done?
Well, you know, presidents are often judged by the extent to which they tear down walls, not that they built them. And this is a hugely important opportunity for this president, this Congress, this moment in our democracy. Itself, of course, is still in crisis. We are still living in these alternative universes where we don't differ on opinions, we differ on facts themselves. And that is a cancer at the heart of the democratic experiment that we have to continue to treat and tend to. But legislation matters. Policing reform could end up being a generational, multi-generational landmark work of legislation. You know, we've pointed out, if it weren't for those folks with the cell phone cameras, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. And George Floyd would still be dead. So I think it was Jeremy Bentham, the English philosopher, who said that publicity is the very soul of justice. Publicity is the very soul of justice. When light is cast on issues, we can at least address them. Right now, it seems to me the president, the administration, the Congress, the governors, the mayors, and again, all of us, the light is cast on this question. It's though there's often nuance in human affairs and issues, there's not a lot of nuance, if any, in the worst of what we've seen. And all these other cases have happened. I think the Reverend's going to preach today at a funeral. Mm-hmm. So we have to keep after it. And that doesn't mean you discount the delivery of accountability and the verdict. But you do have to see this, it seems to me, in the same way we saw the civil rights movement, which is that the sit-ins were not the whole battle. The freedom rides were not the whole battle. Selma was not the whole battle. This is a skirmish one. But a war for justice goes on, and it's going to go on forever because we're human beings. And until we, again, close this gap between our profession of devotion to the Declaration and our practice of identity and selfish politics and culture, until that gap is closed more instead of widened,
right,
we're going to be back here having this conversation again.
Yeah, sure. I'm afraid you're right. It must be addressed. And Willie Geis and I can, of course, confirm that it was indeed Jeremy Bentham,
yeah,
18th century reformer, social justice warrior, that. And of course, the founder of modern Unitarianism. So, yes, John, you did get that historical artifact.
Okay.
And
extra credit for John today.
Very lively. Yeah. Give him.
Well, I want to go to Rev.
It's a point.
As we wrap things up for this block here, for this important conversation about something John Meacham said, and if it wasn't for those cameras, if it wasn't for that cell phone, and you think about all the times that perhaps something like this might have happened and it wasn't seen. So for those debates we had over body cams, which I can't even believe we debated that. You know, accountability is needed, and being seen and having these recordings is vital from all angles. And it helps provide accountability. And I'm just wondering also, Rev, if there's room in this conversation as we close it for this block, to say that it also shows that there are a lot of good cops out there.
I think that it shows that there are good cops, and I think they will be exemplified by the policemen that testified at the Chauvin trial. I also think that it showed the expansion of social media and technology made more people film. Don't forget, there was a video of Rodney King 30 years ago, and those police were acquitted. There was a video of Eric Garner, and those police never went to court. It was that it kept coming. And, you know, that people of faith believe God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things. That young teenager with her little niece that filmed this, and we met her at the first funeral. She came. She was getting threats. She just did the right thing. And for whatever reason, it ignited something that has turned now to be historic. My two fears, Mika, was that if we won, we would say, oh, we won the case and move on and not go for legislation. I don't want people to celebrate so that they forget that we have not, in many ways, reached the goal line, which was new legislation. My other fear is that people not mock this and misuse this to start acting in some way irresponsible and bragging the police they can do whatever they want and get in their face in a way that makes mockery of this victory, because we didn't win this to become anti-police or to see what we can get away with or say to police in some disparaging way today. We won a trial. Now let's see if we can win history, and we should show that we're worthy of the opportunity to make history here in a dignified way, in the way we wanted police to handle us in a dignified way.
Amen. That trial, I believe, history will show it to be, just like the year that led up to the trial, an inflection point. But the question is, what's America going to do now in this moment? And now that we're at that inflection point, we have decisions to make. And it is my hope that Democrats in Congress, as well as enough Republicans, understand there's so many good police officers out there. And as Joe Biden said, and I think this is so important, Joe Biden talked about those police officers who last night had to kiss their children goodnight, had to hug their spouse goodnight, and then put on the badge and go out through the night and protect us, all of us. those good cops, they need to be recognized. They need our prayers, and they need our support through legislation that will lift them up and that will pull out and call out the bad cops. We don't believe that their duty is to protect and serve. There are so many that we're so grateful for.
Right.
And we thank God for them and what they do when they say goodnight to their children and go out to protect us. They have to be lifted up now, too, by legislation that encourages their type of behavior and calls out the behavior of the bad cops.
Reverend Al, thank you all for your work on all of these cases and this issue for so many years. John Meacham, Jonathan Lemire, thank you both as well. We're going to have a lot more ahead on this historic moment. We'll be joined by Congresswoman Val Demings for her reaction to the verdict and also what was behind her heated exchange yesterday with Republican Congressman Jim Jordan during a hearing on police reform. Plus, the latest on the pandemic. Vaccines have nearly eliminated death and hospitalization from coronavirus. So then why are so many vaccinated people still fearful? The New York Times' David Leonhardt joins us with his new piece on that topic. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.